This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 241, was recorded on October 15th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases, and by FarmTogether.com, bringing farmland, a new trillion-dollar investment opportunity, within reach of all accredited investors. We're going to do a special show on uranium this week, a commodity whose fundamentals are really looking good for a turnaround. Mike Alkin and Guy Keller join me as this week's feature interview guests. Mike and Guy are both fund managers in the uranium mining space, and they've both got some excellent insights on this market to share with you. Patrick Serezna is off this week, so Kevin Muir, author of the popular Macro Tourist blog, returns again as this week's co-host.
And I'm Kevin Muir, in for Patrick Serezna. Eric, let's jump to it. The spoos appeared a little rudderless this week, and one day we're watching a march straight up, and then abruptly the next day the selling comes in and is offered. What do you make of the action?
Oh, I think it's all about the election. We're into the final weeks. The election is now the predominant force that's affecting the market. And of course, you know, the news is up and down. One minute we've got the story breaking about the Biden crime family, and then we see it's from Rudy Giuliani, and everybody kind of rolls their eyes and says, okay, it's just Rudy. You know, maybe we don't take that too seriously. And then all of a sudden, Twitter and Facebook are censoring it. Well, that really brings, you know, big questions into how this election is being managed. And, you know, it's one thing after another. I think the reason you're seeing all the volatility in the market is because markets can't figure out what's happening. To me, a contested election to some degree is not even a question. It's a certainty in my mind. The question is how much unrest and political backlash is there going to be from the people who don't get their way? And how does that compare to what's already been priced in? And of course, it's hard to gauge exactly what's already been priced in. But I think that we're really waiting to see how much, you know, backfire there is or how much resistance there is to the outcome of the election. And, I don't think it's a clean sweep by any stretch. I think that whoever doesn't win is going to not concede, and we'll see what happens.
So let's move on to the U.S. dollar. The decline of the past month seems to have stalled, and now the U.S. dollar is actually poking its head up. Is this the start of something bigger?
I don't think there's any reason to conclude that it needs to be. I mean, finally, yeah, we're seeing some strength this week, but it's not enough to set a technical direction. I think you still need a daily close over 95 on the dollar index or below 92 if you want to go the other direction to draw a technical analysis conclusion. My best guess is the consolidation continues through the election. And then I think if there were a really big surprise in the sense of excessive civil unrest and violence and so forth, I think that would be dollar negative. I think if it all blows over, and particularly if there was a clean sweep and everyone agrees who the president is in 2021, which frankly seems unlikely to me, I think that would be very dollar positive. So I think we need to wait for the election and see what happens.
So crude oil continues to stay confined in this narrow trading band. Any hope for some action in the energy markets anytime soon?
Well, Kevin, I want to go back to my comments in last week's show about the back of curve time spreads and how they often serve as a leading indicator for what's coming in the flat price. As you say, if we look at flat price action, we're in a narrow trading band. The chart doesn't really speak to me and say anything about direction from here. On the other hand, if I look at those back of curve time spreads, and my favorite spread to look at is Z1, Z2, the December 21 through December 22 time spread. Until today, it was consistently, for more than a week, just staying, rallying above its five-day moving average, above all of its short-term moving averages. On this morning's spike down in flat price, we did get a retest of those short-term moving averages just about perfectly touching the 13-day moving average at 80 cents, but now recovering nicely above the 8 and almost back to the 5. The 5-day moving average, which is the highest of the moving averages, and again, the market stayed above those short-term moving averages on a closing basis for the last couple of weeks. That number is 57 cents negative, 57 cents of contango. We're at 62 cents of contango right now, which is just above the 8-day moving average. So, you know, it looks to me like we're seeing a signal from the back of the curve that higher prices may be in the works. A stumble today, a retest of those short-term moving averages. It's going to be really interesting to see. This was a close below the 5-day, the first one in a couple of weeks on the Z1, Z2 spread. I'm watching that as maybe a precursor of what's coming. If I look at the flat price, it's not really telling me anything on that chart as far as what's coming next. Inventory this week definitely helped the recovery off of the spike down in price, which we saw this morning. Crude oil drawing down 3.8 million barrels. Now, that's the officially designated commercial storage. If you add the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which these days is also a form of commercial storage, which is another 1.2 million barrels, it was a total drawdown of 5 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma, on the other hand, building 2.9 million barrels. Gasoline drawing down 1.6 million barrels, and the really big drawdown this week was in distillates, 7.2 million barrel drawdown. That's the biggest one-week drawdown in distillate inventories in 17 years. U.S. production was down considerably by 500,000 barrels to 10.5 million. But again, remember, we had the storm roll through the Gulf, shutting in some production last week. So I don't think that's the beginning of the epic fall in U.S. production that Art Berman has predicted later in Q4. I think that significant drop this week was really just a transient effect of tropical storm activity in the Gulf. In any event, tape action was a nice rally as those draws were confirmed. Time spread performance, as I said earlier, is often a reliable signal of where flat price is headed. That chart looks much more bullish than the flat price chart does.
Let's move on to gold. It's hanging in there, but really nothing to write home about. Is gold waiting for the election as well?
Well, Kevin, one of the rules that I've learned over the years about technical analysis is when you have two converging trend lines, either in a wedge or a descending triangle or what have you, it's always worthwhile to look at, okay, where do those two lines converge on the chart? What date is that? And ask yourself, what's significant about that date? Well, in this case, it's really easy. The two trend lines converge at the election. So it's very clear to me that gold is waiting to see what is going to happen in this election. And I think the fundamentals here are that we've got a lot of expectation of a potential increase in civil unrest that is already priced in. I think if you had a clean sweep and a widely accepted agreement on who's president, I think it's bearish for gold and we end up moving much lower. And I don't want to say much, much lower, but a more significant correction than we've seen so far. On the other hand, I think that if you went, you know, in the extreme to incipient civil war, well, then I think gold would be through the roof to the upside. Until then, we're hanging out in this descending triangle or wedge pattern. The support is the 100-day moving average now at 1883, and the resistance is descending triangle resistance at 1925. That upper resistance was perfectly tested over the course of last week. It was 1936 at the time. We got a perfect test of it. And, you know, now it looks like we've actually been back down almost perfectly testing that 100-day. I wouldn't be surprised if we continue to bounce around in this range until the election outcome becomes a little bit clearer.
Eric, let's end with bonds. Last week, we had an uptick in yields, but the bond sell-off seems to have met some buyers. And yields are now down back towards the middle of the recent channel. Is this the new normal we can expect for bonds? A whole lot of nothing?
Well, Kevin, I think a whole lot of nothing is the perfect description for this. And frankly, I'll just say the reason I think it's a whole lot of nothing is because a whole lot of people are just as confused as I am. We know that there's a good argument to be made for a secular shift to inflation, which would be very bearish for bonds and mean yields would be headed much higher. We also know that it's an easy mistake to make to be potentially several years early making a call like that. And how many people have been wrong saying the 30-year bond bull market is over? Well, that was 8 years ago and it wasn't over. Well, the 35-year bond bull market is over. Well, no, it wasn't. Well, we're up to 38 years now. Is it really over, or are we headed to 40 years before it's over? I don't know. I think we're near the end, and I think that at a turning point in a major secular trend like this, it's an easy place to be wrong. So the reason there's a whole lot of nothing is because nobody has a whole lot of conviction, because nobody can figure it out.
This week's feature interview guests are uranium fund managers Mike Alkin and Guy Keller. Eric, why uranium this week, and why these guests in particular?
Well, we've gotten a lot of listener feedback that you'd like more commodity-oriented content, and we're actually working behind the scenes to try to design even more commodity-oriented content in coming months on Macro Voices. But I wanted to start here with uranium because I think it's a really interesting story. We've heard about it in the past from Marin Katusa, but I wanted to do a show with fund managers who really focus specifically on this sector of uranium, because I really believe that nuclear energy is going to continue to be very important for a very long time. And we really need to look at what has happened, the destruction in the market capitalization of the uranium mining industry. This is an industry that's gone from $150 billion in market cap to $5 billion in market cap over a period of several years. So it's really, really important. Now, what these two guests both have in common is they run funds that have had to maneuver because although there's great opportunities in this space, it's capacity limited. In the case of Mike Alkin's fund, it's closed to new investors because he doesn't want more money right now because it's too hard to find the right deals. In the case of Guy Keller, his fund is still open, but they had to spin off a new fund to focus on uranium because their existing natural resources fund was so big that if they had tried to invest in uranium through that fund, they were at a market size where their investments would, you know, be too large for what the market can sustain. So they had to spin off a new fund for just that reason. So, you know, what does that say to you, Kevin, about what might be coming when you start to see more institutional money pile into this space as the market clearly turns around? We're early in the turnaround story, but I think it is a turnaround and it's a very interesting one. Listeners, we know many of you agree with us that we're the best financial podcast on the internet because that's what iTunes and Apple Podcasts used to say about us. Unfortunately, we haven't been reminding you to do those ratings and reviews, which keep us in our number one slot, which we really feel like we deserve. And by the way, that's what helps us get the very best feature guests to come on the program. So your ratings and reviews really do help us to get better feature interviews for your future listening pleasure. Writing a five-star review for Macro Voices is simple. The instructions, step-by-step, are in your Research Roundup email. This episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In recent weeks, we've been reminded of the fragility of world financial markets and how quickly sentiment can shift from risk on to risk off. Once again, the mantra of buy the dip and the determination of central banks will be put to the test. But as Chris Cole recently told us, the best approach to investing in the long run is very different from what's worked best in recent decades. To help Macro Voices listeners navigate an uncertain future, Niels Kastrup Larsen, host of the Top Traders Unplugged podcast, has created a guide to the best investment books of all time. You can get a free copy at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your Research Roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Mike Alkin and Guy Keller is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Today's topic is uranium, and I have two expert guests joining me. First, Mike Alkin is fund manager and founder of the Sachem Cove Special Opportunity Fund, a fund which invests in uranium. Guy Keller is the portfolio manager for the Nuclear Energy Opportunity Fund for Tribeca Investment Partners. Mike prepared a slide deck, actually shared the pitch deck from his hedge fund with us. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you're not a registered user yet, just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads right above Mike and Guy's photos. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us. I want to start with kind of the big picture because I think a lot of people kind of felt like, okay, nuclear energy, really important industry. Well, but then Fukushima happened, and boy, even though people like you and I who tend to focus on logic and reasons understand that nuclear energy is still the safest form of energy we know how to generate, frankly, the world doesn't work on logic and reason. It works on public sentiment and emotion, and that emotion was so strongly anti-nuclear that a lot of people just wrote off nuclear power and said, okay, this industry's done at this point. How should we be thinking about the nuclear power industry? Does it have a future, and how much of a future does it have? Let's start with Mike Alkin from Sachem Cove.
It's an excellent question, Eric. Clearly, the electric utility industry around the world plays second fiddle to the alternative energy markets, marketing people. And it's been this way going back since the beginning of time. The word nuclear scares people. And as you mentioned in your question or in your comment during the question was it is the safest form of electricity generation per terawatt hour of energy produced. But it's not viewed that way. You've had three major incidents. You had Three Mile Island in the U.S. in the 70s, and then you had Chernobyl, which people know about in the mid-80s, and then Fukushima, as you mentioned, in March of 2011. But there have been very few actual deaths from those. But at the end of the day, there's been a big, big push and a big sentiment change the last couple of years towards nuclear power. And that big push is driven by climate change. And when you look at the facts, the reality is nuclear power is clean, safe, and reliable. And science shows that if you want to achieve these climate goals over the next few decades, you can't get there just with renewables. It just doesn't work. There's not enough. There's too much intermittency. Storage costs are very expensive to store the electricity. And many, many scientists and even politicians are starting to recognize if we want to get there and achieve these goals, nuclear power has to be part of the playbook. And so for the first time, you know, when Fukushima had its problems in 2011, at the time, Japan was 13% of global nuclear power. And they had 54 reactors, and all of them over the next year or two went offline. And you're still not back. You only have about 9 operating reactors that are online in Japan. So you're quite a way away from getting back to where they originally were. But for the first time in the past year, global nuclear power output is above pre-Fukushima levels. And that's because there's somewhat of a nuclear renaissance that's taking place. You have over 50 reactors around the world under construction, $500 billion that are in process construction. And so you are seeing people recognize that nuclear needs to be part of the playbook to achieve climate change. It's safe. And it's importantly, it's pretty much 24/7. It's there. It's reliable. So you are seeing I wouldn't say a major sea change, but you're seeing an acceptance of nuclear power needing to be part of the mix.
Guy, what would you add to that?
Yeah, thanks, Eric. I mean, I think Mike's made some fantastic points there. And I mean, the point to really ram home is that as long as achieving a low or zero carbon future remains the goal of global society, then nuclear energy cannot be ignored. You know, it has to have a part to play. Because it is 24/7, low carbon or almost zero carbon, baseload electricity. And, you know, we're getting 60 to 80 years out of these reactors now. So when you talk about sort of post-Fukushima, when the general public want to get their science from 20 years of watching The Simpsons and more recently of watching a bit of HBO disaster porn on, you know, that Chernobyl series, you know, that's it does entrench bias and beliefs, But, you know, I point to just the number of high-profile environmentalists, you know, and in the United States over there, there's one very prominent man who basically wrote the book on anti-nuclear, who's done a complete 180 and has now, you know, come to the conclusion that, that for the world to be truly carbon neutral, it needs nuclear. So, you know, and down here in Australia, we have the same thing where there's a growing band of scientists and environmentalists who were anti-nuclear energy, who are now realizing as well that that there needs to be a part to play in the future. So, you know, as I said, you know, to Mike's point that sentiment is changing. You know, we're seeing that via that. And you know, I think also with political acceptance down here in Australia, there's much more of a dialogue around uranium mining and potentially future, you know, nuclear power provision as new technologies come into play. But, you know, we've certainly noticed that change in the last 2 or 3 years.
And Erica, if I could just jump in real quick, if you look on in our deck on slide 8, we talk about the days of full power of different generating sources. Nuclear generates about almost 350 days a year at full power. And you compare that even to coal and natural gas, where it's a little over 150 to 175 days. And then you get down to solar and wind, and you're looking at less than 100 and a little over 100. And a very interesting example would be in Germany, where Germany post-Fukushima decided they were going to wean themselves off of nuclear power, which was a significant portion of their electricity grid. So 2012 to today, they have spent hundreds of billions of dollars to get there. And what you've seen is their carbon output is neutral. And the cost of electricity is up 4 times. Why? Because the renewables can't be there all the time. So they've actually had to build some coal. And so it's just a very, very difficult thing to either eliminate nuclear power or to not include it in your future goals.
Now, there's something that I'm quite certain has collapsed since Fukushima, and that is investment capital coming into this industry. And that's resulted in just a tremendous collapse in the size of the mining industry. And I'm sure you guys can give me some statistics on that. But why don't we get to how big is the uranium mining industry? And let's pretend that we just need to run the existing power plants. Forget about even building any new ones, because that's obviously somewhat politically contentious. Is there enough capacity in the existing mining industry to service the existing nuclear reactors that are still in service?
So it's a good question, a very good question, Eric. The title of our deck is Climbing a Wall of Worry, Price is Everything. So capacity today exists, but nowhere near the price that capacity can produce profitably. And so when you look at the amount of, you know, less than half of the miners in the world today at these prices, in spot price at 30, and then you go a little bit out on the curve, the long-term contracts are a little bit more, only about less than half make money. So it's not so much the capacity, it's the price at which that capacity can be productive and profitable. And that's where, you know, you're talking on average, the marginal producer needs to make about $50. And so you're at a price today of 30. So yes, there is capacity out there, but the incentive to bring that capacity, which has been cut, you've seen 25% of world supply been cut since the end of 16. That capacity needs a price incentive to be able to produce. And that's the opportunity that we see in uranium. It's the price will incent production. If it doesn't, some reactors are going to run out of fuel.
Guy, tell me about the size of the industry. How much of a collapse have we seen in the market capitalization of uranium mining compared to where it was, I don't know, pre-Fukushima sometime?
Oh, I mean, it's a fraction of what it was in the last bull market. I mean, you know, I think the statistic a lot of people throw around is there was aroundabouts globally 500 listed opportunities that had something to do with uranium. And now there's, you know, probably 50, of which maybe only half of those are investable. I mean, when we looked at the opportunity, so I'm also part of our larger Global Natural Resources Fund, which is from that fund is where we started looking at the uranium opportunity. And we could not make an investment case work in that fund to the extent we wanted to, because the fund was too big and we wouldn't be able to get the position sizes that we needed. So that's why we ended up spinning out the smaller Nuclear Energy Opportunities Fund, you know, just so that we could have a concentrated portfolio of exposure that wasn't going to mean that we were, you know, substantial shareholders in every single thing we moved into.
And Eric, if I could just go back to the question about enough capacity, you know, one of the things when you talk about the uranium mining world, you have to have a discussion about Kazakhstan, the country of Kazakhstan, and the state-owned entity called Kazatomprom. And Kazatomprom has a little over 20% of global market share, but there are several joint ventures in Kazakhstan where they participate in. So they're, the country of Kazakhstan is about 40%. And then there are some other state-owned producers that you have, like the Russians, the Chinese, the Uzbeks, the French. So a lot of times people will say, well, it's state-owned production, and that can meet all demand because they're not price sensitive. Actually, the Kazakhs have gone, they floated now 25% of the company starting back in 18, and they've been incredibly supply disciplined. And when you look at all of the productive capacity in the state-owned entities, it's running at about 70, in pre-COVID, about 70, 75% of capacity because it wasn't incented at price. But one of the things we do is if we were to look at all of the state-owned capacity in the world, which also includes, we include Olympic Dam, which is the big copper mine owned by BHP, where uranium is a byproduct. But if we included all of that and we included all of the production that comes out of some of the care and maintenance mines, that MacArthur River does not come back, which is a big mine owned by Cameco, but we include Cigar Lake, another mammoth mine owned by Cameco. When you start including these back into the mix, when you include all of these pounds being produced, you're still looking at a few hundred million pound deficit over the next decade. And you could see that in our slide deck. We start talking about it from slide 22 to like 25 or 26. The reality is there is, let's round, use some round numbers over the next several years. And when you talk mining, as you know, these things take, it could take 15, 20 years to find, develop, permit, and bring it into production. So a decade is tomorrow. You know, you're looking at a structural deficit right now of over 30 million pounds per year, but that keeps growing because you have some mine depletions that come on. But as the price stays low and it doesn't incent the development of these new projects, you're talking deficits that can stretch out into the 40, 50 million pound per year range. Now, there, of course, there are some secondary supplies, but in round numbers, you're talking 200 million pounds of demand. If you were talking the Kazakhs running at full production, all the state-owned folks running at full production, you still are tens of millions of pounds annually short, including secondary supplies that could come into the market, which would be a structural deficit for many years to come. And again, the elixir for that is price. In the last cycle, you saw the price of uranium go from $10 up to $137 in the spot market over a few year period. If we were to look at all the mines that could come online, that could meet all the demand needs, we estimate you're probably in the $70, $75 range. Now, that wasn't too different from last cycle, but what happened? Fear. Fear ruled the day, and utilities were contracting like there was no tomorrow. They normally contract, you know, your consumption, but they were contracting for years at 120, 130, up to 150% of their annual consumption over multi-year contracts of 7, 8, 9, 10 years. So there is supply out there, but price plays a huge role in it, and time, because the longer it waits, the less uranium that's going to be available. There's probably $4 billion worth of mines that need to be constructed. And at these prices, nobody's financing that.
Yeah, sorry. But also, I think to add there, Mike, as well, you know, it's management, it's permitting, and it's jurisdiction as well. You know, I mean, there's not too many management teams left in uranium that have successfully bought a mine on in the last 10 years. You know, there's jurisdictions where, you know, on a headline basis, they look like a safe and friendly. I mean, Australia is a perfect example. Australia looks like a great friendly uranium jurisdiction, but when you go and delve down into state by state, if you're in the state of Western Australia or Queensland, you've got problems. You know, so price, then assuming you can get capital investment, and you've got a management team that can actually go and construct the mine, there's still a whole lot of bunch of hurdles. So if the price responds tomorrow, for example, that deficit is not magically fixed in 6 to 12 months. It's a much longer process.
Mike, I want to go back to what you said a minute ago about these contracts that they're buying uranium from. As a futures trader, I remember a few years ago getting interested in uranium, thinking, okay, I don't need the ETF. I'll just, trade it on the futures market. And then I looked, there's no liquidity in that contract. I don't know why they even have it listed.
Exactly.
So how does this market work? You mentioned the spot market. Who's actually buying and selling uranium, and what are the terms that occurs under?
Great question, and it's one of the most complicated aspects for people to get their head around who are coming into the market to learn it. So typically, for a nuclear power plant, security of supply is paramount. And just to give some context around what fuel buying is, if you're running a coal-fired or natural gas-fired power plant, the feedstock, nat gas or coal, is probably 80 to 90% of the costs. For uranium, the front end of the fuel cycle, and it goes through many steps. It comes out of the ground, it's mined, it's then converted to something called UF6, and then it's enriched, which everyone has heard of enrichment, and it's fabricated, and then it winds up at the plant gate in fuel rods. Well, that takes a couple of years, but the actual, and that's about 20, that front end is about 20% of the operating costs versus 80 and 90 for the fossil fuel plants. But the uranium itself is mid to high single digits of the actual cost. So it's not a significant input cost. And so historically, because security of supply, there's no substitute. Once you build a plant, you spend several billion to build it, you have to have uranium. It takes a long time. There's fires, there's floods. A lot of stuff happens that typically 75, 80% of this industry is driven off of long-term contracts that are 7, 8, 9, 10, and sometimes many years longer than that. And so what you saw in the last cycle was you had a lengthy bear market, and price had even gone down to 7 at one point, but it was bopping along in the early 2000s at $10, $12, $14. And when you started to see that, and again, not a lot of pounds trading in spot, inventories had been worked down over the years, and then you started to see there was a flood at one mine. There was a fire at another mine. There were a series of events that took place that scared the fuel buyers. And they were going out and contracting, as I said earlier, at 120 to 150% of their annual consumption needs. And when you look at that, what they did is those contracts that started in 05, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, they started to roll off in the middle part of the teens. But what happened were there are two things that were occurring in the marketplace that were that one was anticipated, one wasn't. Nobody anticipated Fukushima. So at that time, you had over 20 million pounds per year, 13% of world demand, all of a sudden kind of go offline. And so when you saw that, you saw utilities who had contracted heavily were covered out for the years. And that created a buffer for the mining companies. Everyone assumed at the time in 2011 that the Japanese would come right back online. How can they not? It was almost 30% of their grid. But they didn't. And they found alternative sources to generate electricity, more expensive, but alternative. And so the miners were continuing to explore, develop, and produce throughout the early 20-teens and the mid-and starting in the mid-20-teens. And then you had what they were anticipating was that this downblending program that started in 1993 called Megatons to Megawatts. There were thousands of nuclear missiles, ballistic missiles, that the U.S. government was afraid that those missiles would wind up on the black market. So they incentivized the Russian government to downblend them, and they would send 20, 25 million pounds a year of uranium into the market. Well, that was scheduled to go offline in 2013. So as Guy mentioned earlier, the planning that goes into these, there were many mines planning on coming online because that program was going offline. But then Fukushima happened, but you couldn't stop those programs. So you saw new production coming online into the downturn. And so what hit a spot price in 07 of 137, by Fukushima, it was $70, and it just kept going down. But then something in the market had occurred that you hadn't seen before because interest rates were at the floor. What you started to see was financial intermediaries come into the market and introduce something that commodity investors are familiar with, but really wasn't in the uranium market, was the carry trade. And so in the world of physical trading of uranium, there's only a handful of traders. And most of them don't have much of a balance sheet. And they trade this uranium back and forth, very little volumes in the spot market. Like I said, maybe only 20% of annual volumes are there. But they trade for 15, 20, 25 cents a pound back and forth. But then they were very smart, as were the utilities. They said, look, there's a lot of oversupply in the market. There's new production coming online. Why, when these contracts expire, should we enter into new ones? Let's see where the market settles out. There was excess supply in the market. So these traders would go out and enter into forward carry market, carry trades a couple of years out on the curve. And they would say, okay, well, Mr. Utility, Mrs. Utility, we will enter into a two-year deal with you. I'm making an example. Enter into a two-year deal. We'll buy the uranium. We'll carry it. And we'll charge you, you know, a little bit out on the curve. We make a little bit of money and everyone's happy. And then in 2 years from now, let's revisit. We don't see a reason why the price of uranium should go up. And they were right, because there was that excess supply. So you saw what was contracting in the 07, 05, 06, 07, 08 period of 120 to 150%. You saw in the mid-teens, even continuing to up until today, contracting into 30 and 40% of annual consumption. So they weren't replacing their consumption. They were drawing down all these excess inventories that built. But the deliveries that are heading into the utilities right now are starting to fall off a cliff. And that's where something called uncovered demand comes into play. And if you look at the uncovered demand, contracts that are required, demand that is out there that's not covered by contracts, it's almost identical. And that's on chart 33, slide 33, as it was right before the last major boom. So utilities are not covered by contracts. And if you look at slide 32, you've got a delivery waterfall into the utilities that is falling off a cliff. It dramatically declines. So now they're left to trying to have to figure out where these pounds will come from. Well, there's not enough. The price isn't high enough to incent new production. The price isn't high enough to get these mines who cut supply through care and maintenance going idle because price isn't high enough. Or they can try and go out and secure it in the spot market. Well, 3 years ago, if I wanted to go find 10 million pounds of uranium in the spot market, 15 million pounds of uranium in the spot market, I could do it. If I was to try and go out right now and get delivery within a few months to the converter, and I wanted to find probably more than a million, million and a half pounds, I couldn't find it. So it's not enough to meet the needs. So contracts are expiring. The future demand is not covered by contracts, and you have a very tight spot market. Sorry to be long-winded on that, but there's a lot of nuance in there, and I just wanted to explain what's going on in the market right now.
That's okay. I want to pick up on that, though, because we've already discussed the fact that if you just look at the existing nuclear plants and the need to fuel them, there's going to be a major shortfall. I suspect a lot of investors are probably making a mistake that I made until I talked to you guys a little bit off the air, which is I would have assumed, look, post-Fukushima, this can't be a growth industry. They can't be building any more nuclear power plants because this public sentiment is so strong. I was very mistaken to think that. So, Guy, why don't we start with you on this one? Are there actually new nuclear plants being built? And if so, how many? Does this come anywhere close to the magnitude of the, let's say, the heyday of nuclear energy in the 1970s when they were building plants left and right?
Yeah, Eric, I mean, we're currently in one of the biggest reactor build programs that we've had that we've seen in decades. And you know, a lot of the market glosses over that. I mean, we always talk to the number that there's 50-odd reactors under construction and a number planned and a number proposed. But we never actually sort of pause to really scratch the surface of that detail to work out what that is. I mean, you know, it's a number. It is what it is. But when you look at, for example, what China are currently building at the moment, so they've got a shovel in the ground on reactor builds, you know, so these are reactors that should be finished and connected to the grid between now and 2025. You know, it's over 10 to 11 million pounds of uranium per year that they're going to need to fuel those new reactors. I mean, you know, when you consider the Husab mine in Namibia, for example, I mean, you know, there's argument as to what that does each year, and it's certainly not doing what it was supposed to do for the nameplate. They need another one of those mines and more just to fuel the reactors that they're building. When you look at ex-China as well, I mean, we see China as the big growth engine, and I still believe that there's much more to come from them. But ex-China, there's a lot of reactors being built as well. And again, between now and 2025, that's there or thereabouts another 18 million pounds of uranium per year, which is equivalent to another MacArthur River, Cameco's, one of Cameco's tier one assets that needs to come into production to fulfill that. I mean, I'm ignoring front loading of fuel for all these reactors, which, you know, when you basically start a reactor, you need three times the amount of your annual requirement. I'm ignoring that in these numbers even. So when you look at the fact that there's a deficit now with just what is currently running, there's going to be an even bigger deficit in the next 5 years when the reactors that are being currently built connect to the grid. And when you then look at what China's doing, I mean, China has put out a 2060, you know, carbon neutral plan, which sounds like a long way away, but that's China. They'll be starting to come out with some headlines on their 14th five-year plan at the end of October. You know, it's my view that their already ambitious nuclear reactor build program is going to increase because it has to. You know, so not only are you seeing ex-China with a healthy build program, China's also got a great one at the moment. But if that gets even bigger, then this story just continues to be fundamentally skewed in such a way that price just has to catch up, or China goes on some massive buying spree of every uranium resource in the world to fulfill their needs, which also fulfills the same goal.
Mike, is there anything you want to add on the scope of the building that's going on? And particularly, maybe you can address the timing. When do we see new plants that are being built coming online and actually starting to consume fuel rods?
Good question, Eric. So there's a steady stream coming on over the next 5, 6, 7 years. You'll see, and like Guy said, when a new reactor starts, the initial fuel load is up to three times the amount that is needed because you're putting a few loads in there to fill the reactor up. And so you will see a steady stream of these coming online. And we don't, in our calculus, we do not include those that are planned and proposed because we just want to know what is. Because once you've started one of these things, you know, with the exception of one in the U.S., two in the U.S., they finish. And the Western world builds reactors way over budget and way over time, but they've got this down to a science. The Russians and the Chinese who own the nuclear fuel cycle to a large extent. They build them on time, on budget, and they have
So do the South Koreans as well, right?
They've got South Koreans as well. You're right. They're very, very efficient at it. So you will see a steady stream of these coming online. And one of the things that was not part of our thesis, we started looking at this really late 15, early 16, spent a year just trying to understand, because I, like you, Eric, and like many people, you know, I'm a deep value investor, been in the hedge fund business 25 years, but you know, my view of nuclear power was a layperson's view. And I thought for sure, let me go, you know, wow, I see this disconnect, 500 companies down to 50, a market cap of 150 billion down to under 5 billion at the time. We were mentioning offline, when I first started looking, the sell side models were 3 years old. They were dated. Anyone who was a uranium analyst was fired. And anyone who was, so they gave it to a precious metals analyst to look at it. And it's a wildly complicated industry and it's so opaque that it was ignored. And so from a professional investor standpoint, I still thought nuclear was dead. But as you start looking at the demand at the end of the day, when you take into all of these closures that in the West that will occur, in Europe, there's going to be closures. In the US, there will be closures. You factor that into the math and net at the end of the day, over the next decade, it's a 2% grower. So it's not a fancy, sexy growth business, but it's a growth business. And that's the exciting part because the narrative is so entrenched with nuclear's dying. And just the simple fourth grade math doesn't bear out those facts just based on what exists and what's in under construction right now.
I want to test out my own hypothesis on this industry with you guys and see what you think. But it goes back to something Mike said earlier in the conversation about environmentalists. I think the sea change moment for the nuclear power industry is when the environmental community, which clearly has the public ear, changes their tune and says, hey, it's safe nuclear power that's going to be the solution to our carbon problem, and we got to really invest in safe nuclear. But frankly, to save face, they can't say old Westinghouse reactors are safe. We were lying when they said they weren't. There's got to be something different. Now, it seems to me, I don't know, a story I heard a few years ago was that there was a change afoot where instead of building these massive, massive nuclear power plants that are built on site in position and often have all kinds of fraud and stuff going on with the construction project, there was discussion of a new trend where a much safer generation, a new generation of nuclear reactor, which was modular and small, would be built in super high quality control level factories and then shipped to where it was going to be used. And that might be a game changer. Is that still a big trend that we care about? And would it potentially give the environmental community that, I'll call it a face-saving moment to say, well, if we do it this way, then nuclear is safe? Because I think that changes the world.
Without a doubt, there are these small modular reactors, which, you know, are, let's say, 50, 60, 100 megawatt reactors, and some even the micro ones much smaller. It gives the nuclear industry the ability to mass produce, right? That's not how they're built now. To put it in context, every reactor is 440-ish in the world right now. The fuel rods that go into those reactors, not one is interchangeable with another reactor. Everyone's different, right? There's a handful of builders of these reactors, but there's not that consistency. Now post Fukushima, the safety standards are incredibly safe. The numbers bear that out. But this enables you to put these smaller reactors in smaller neighborhoods, smaller cities. They're better economics for all involved. For the manufacturers and for the users. And, you know, one of the things I think is we talk all of this talk of EVs and the green future and the Green New Deal. Well, the more wind and solar you have on the grid, you have all these EVs when they're going to power these cars at night. Well, what's going to power those? Coal? Natural gas? The wind only blows at certain times, and the sun blows during the day, and the storage, there's not enough storage, and it's too expensive. So, you know, nuclear power and these smaller reactors can help solve that problem. And I think the safety feature of those too, the added benefits to what already is a very safe model, I think does bode well for the industry. Guy, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you know, for the any sort of naysayers with respect to those technology advances, just need to look at the number of countries that are investing in the innovation and technology advances for nuclear. It's not, you know, not just the United States who are very vocal, and the U.S. Department of Energy, in my view, are doing a good job with test labs and things like that. But you've got Canada, you've got France, you've got China, you've got Russia, you've got South Korea, you know, you've got some other fringe countries. All of these countries are spending a huge amount of time, money and effort to advance this reactor technology. And on top of that as well, with existing technology, you've got improvements. You know, there's moves to for accident tolerant fuels and all sorts of things. And when you come back to safety, you've got to remember that the nuclear fuel cycle, starting from uranium in the ground to the waste at the end of the cycle, is the most scrutinized and the most regulated by multinational organizations as well as country governmental and independent organizations. It's the most scrutinized industry in the world with respect to safety and how they deal with things. You know, so I tend to think that the technology advances are very exciting. They're still, you know, 5 to 10 years away. But my view is that where the industry is at the moment, it's in a very good space. And I wouldn't have any problems with a reactor being built in my neighborhood.
Would you guys agree that the world changes completely if the environmentalists get on board and bless nuclear? And if so, what's it going to take? What would be the catalysts if it's not these modular reactors that would get them on board?
Economic reality and technological reality. And I think they're starting to see that. you know, it's hand-to-hand combat, figuratively speaking, but it just takes time. But you are seeing, and I just don't have in my head right now who the various names are that have done this, but you're seeing them come aboard, because as we said earlier, you can't reach your climate goals without nuclear as part of the mix. And then supporting nuclear is just the math of the safety involved. So it's just slowly seeing it. You see it even more now on the Democratic platform in the U.S. You know, Joe Biden's platform is supportive of nuclear power. I don't think you would have seen that out of the Democrats a few years ago. So I think there's this realization that it needs to be there.
Let's move on to the investment opportunities in this space. If I draw an analogy to another metal that a lot of our listeners are familiar with, which is gold, some investors, because of gold's store of value characteristic, want to take physical delivery of the metal, you know, in coins, rounds, and bars. I'm guessing that if you take physical delivery of uranium, you might get a visit from the Department of, I'm not sure which department, but let's not do that.
Yeah.
In terms of the mining companies, the shares in the miners, if I use an analogy to gold, well, you've got ETFs like GDX, and I know in uranium you've got URNM, which is the predominant uranium mining ETF. Now, in the gold space, they break down the mining companies into producers that are actually operating gold mines, and then what are called junior miners, which are the companies that are out doing exploration, figuring out where the next gold mine needs to go, but they're not actually operating a mine yet. Is that how uranium works, and where are the opportunities? Is this something, I got to believe it's much smaller than the gold space in terms of the number of companies. How big is it, and what's the best way to invest in it?
So yes, you do have a similar setup. In the uranium mining world, you have exploration companies, which are going out looking for uranium. And most of those are very tiny. You know, it's kind of like the pharmaceutical industry, you know, how they've kind of let the biotech companies do a lot of their R&D. It's kind of similar in the uranium space and other mining sectors, where you have the small juniors going out and exploring, and they're tiny market cap companies. And once in a while, they come up with something. And then you have the development stage companies. So these junior miners who find something, move it on to the next phase where they'll do a pre-feasibility, a PEA, preliminary economic assessment. They'll move it to a feasibility study, pre-feas, and then a feasibility study. All in the, what they're doing is wrangling to bring this into production. And they may or may not, they may get taken out or not. And then you have the producers. In the world of uranium, your big producers in the West are few and far between. It's Cameco. And then you have a couple of other smaller producers that are on care and maintenance right now. And then you have a lot of state-owned entities around the rest of the world. But it is a similar one. And you know, you just have to really be careful in the junior mining space. It's, it's fraught with promotion. Everyone's a first-tier producer. I'm still waiting to meet the second quartile producer. So everyone's a first quartile producer. They all can bring it on much sooner than one would think, right? So it's heavily promotional, just like all the mining industry is. So you really have to do your due diligence in this space, in the junior sector, to make sure these costs are accurate, to make sure the timelines are accurate. And as Guy said, it was a great point he brought up earlier. There are very, very, very few people running any of these mining companies that have brought uranium mine into production. And it's a lot of work, it's a lot of time, and it's a lot of expertise. So, but it's, the structure is the same.
Let me ask Guy a related question, which is, how can investors who are maybe new to this space go wrong in terms of understanding this market?
Very easily, you know, as Mike alluded to before, there's a lot of snake oil salesmen around, and you know, you can come unstuck. I think one of the things that we take into consideration very seriously is we get an understanding of what it is we want to own a certain stock for. You know, there's certain holdings in our portfolio that we know in its current state, form, and management team will never get into production. But we're not owning it for that, and we're aware of the reasons why we think it won't, and we're aware of what steps that company may need to take to do so. So, you know, it comes down to, it is a very hot and very volatile sector. I mean, our fund performance has thankfully rebounded very aggressively since March this year, where it was looking terrible. And, you know, we were able to position ourselves where we thought it would move. And we have turned that portfolio a little bit and as it's matured through the year here. But I think, you know, it's very easy to come unstuck because even though investors think because it's a small industry and price has to go up, you know, I can buy whatever and it'll work for me. And that's true to an extent, you know, but I think it's very easy to, as I think Mike alluded to before in previous cycles, you can point to all of these fantastic appreciation in some of these uranium stocks in the previous bull cycles. But when you look at the dilution factor, the raisings and everything else that happened, you know, it hasn't actually been potentially as good for some. So, you know, where there's a handful of specialists in this sector that have put in a huge amount of time and effort over the last number of years in getting to know management teams and getting to know the resources. And, you know, I'd even argue that sometimes we come unstuck a little bit too. So, yeah. So it's not without, it's not it's without fun. It is buyer beware. You know, I wouldn't be putting your whole retirement savings into it because it's extremely volatile.
And what you see, Eric, what you tend to see is with these smaller mining companies, there's not a lot of capital markets expertise. You have to be all over management when it comes to how they're spending their capital and burning their cash. And as the market care, you may want to do this, that, and the other thing to bring your mine along in development stage, but the market doesn't care right now and you don't need to do it right now. And like Guy mentioned with the dilution, a lot of these companies have diluted till kingdom come. Right now is coming in new to the space. That's, you know, you're dealing with your math and your valuation based on that. But, you know, it requires a lot of, I don't want to say handholding, but you got to, you know, I'm sure Guy is too. We're pretty tough with the management teams that we have meaningful holdings in because you have to be all over them because it's not, you know, there is not that necessary, that great expertise there. So it can be challenging.
Gentlemen, the most striking thing to me in this interview has been learning a little bit more about what you guys do and specifically your relationship to the market now, because I'm sure that we have a very large accredited investor audience. I'm sure many of them are going to be disappointed to learn. Mike, your Sachem Cove Partners Fund, which has done very well in this space, is closed to new investors. And the reason is because you've reached a size where you feel like you can't really deliver that same excellent performance because, you know, too much money, not chasing not enough opportunity. Guy, by your own description, you were running a much larger fund with much bigger AUM. And as a matter of your mandate, you perfectly well could have gone into this space with that fund, but you decided instead to spin off a new fund because you needed a smaller entity in order to be effective at investing in this space. And, you know, if I hear your story, Mike, you know, usually equity funds close to new investors when they hit $2 billion or so. You're only at $65 million, and you'd had to close at that level. So on the one hand, it strikes me as, oh my gosh, if that's the level you guys have to close at, when this market gets hit with billions of dollars of capital as it turns around, price is going to go through the roof. It's an incredible opportunity. But wait a minute. You guys are really, really good at this, and you're not taking any more money because there's not enough good deals to chase.
Well, hang on. I'm taking a bit more money, Eric, and hopefully I get it in before. Hopefully I get it in before that those billions of dollars of generalist money chase in too.
Okay, but you did spin off a new fund because if you had done this in the other fund you were managing, it would have been too big. You would have been buying too big of a piece of the company. So we have a large institutional audience. I mean, for people who need to put significant amounts of capital to work, it sounds like you really need to be in the know in order to find the next opportunity to put a lot of money to work efficiently.
It's a good point. And, you know, we capped it, right? Because I saw the opportunities that were there. And look, this market cap, the market cap of the industry, like I said, 150 down to, at the time it was 5. Now it's bigger. You know, I don't have it up, but probably 11, 12 billion. But many of these companies, as Guy alluded to earlier, are not investable. But we're not looking at again, if our work is right, and clearly we can be wrong, right? But if our work is right, we're not looking for ordinary returns. We think the asymmetry is such where the risk reward is an asymmetry that I've not been acquainted with before in my career. So again, you see, like I mentioned earlier, in the last cycle, you saw stocks just return 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 times. And Guy and I and a couple of the other guys who run uranium funds, we shake our head because people expect, 50 and 100 baggers again. And those don't exist in our minds simply because there's been so much dilution. But there is still significant upside in many of these if the macro work is right and you pick the right stocks. So we were, rather than go just hoovering up capital, which we could have to do that, that's not fair to our LPs. So we just decided to cap it here. Maybe in the future, if we monitor it and we can open in the future. But as of right now, we don't see the space to put it. And like I said earlier, I think I used the reference, putting a pig through a python. When capital comes back, and again, the sell side is just warming up to the sector again. And it's using the wrong cues because it's following the move in spot price of uranium. And the reason they do that is because it's the only really visible one. And that's triggered off the futures price. And you got to remember, most of the pounds that trade every day, it might not even trade. It's just bid and asks moving around because it trades so infrequently. So people, there is more interest coming back into the sector. What Guy and the folks at Segra Capital and L2, the other uranium funds, what we're focusing on is what's happening in the contracting market, and are we seeing acceleration there, and what's the price curve looking like there, and so because we are deep in the bowels of this sector, at some point in time we may decide to, but yeah. There's going to be a time where the sell side revisits it in mass, where capital warms up to it, and they'll start chasing it.
So for our listeners who are interested in investing in this space, Mike, your fund is presently closed to new investors. You've got the URNM ETF. That's an option. Guy, your fund is still open. Are you accredited investors only? Are you everybody? Tell us a little bit more about your fund.
Yeah, so we run a wholesale investment fund here at the moment. It's set up as an Aussie unit trust because the bulk of our investors are ourselves. We basically started with partner money here, some fairly bullish uranium investors who'd been in who are still in our Global Natural Resources Fund, and then pushed it out a little bit further to an Australian investor base. We do have the ability to launch a parallel structure and a Cayman US dollar vehicle. There was a cost equation with that, obviously. If the appetite is there, we'd still consider that. But, as I said, we've been small, and it's been a little bit of a saving grace over the first 2 years of the fund because we did have a few false starts in the sector, and it allowed us to be in positions without having a massive financial hit when things weren't going right. I mean, we also do leverage off our Global Natural Resources Fund, so we have global relationships because we have been in the resources sector through North America, through Europe, through Australia and Asia for many years. So we have had the ability where, we're still getting treated fairly by brokers and what have you, despite the small size of the nuclear fund because of the bigger relationship there.
Eric, if I could just jump in, there is one other way for bigger investors to express the view, and you saw it significantly in the last cycle, was you can buy physical uranium. You can't have it delivered to your garage, but you can buy physical uranium by establishing an account with one of the converters who will store it. So one can go out, it's cost a little bit of money to set up an account, probably $25,000, but they will store the physical uranium. It's yours. It has your name on it. And it's an interesting time. In the last cycle, what wound up happening is you saw when the market started to just go through the roof, what you started to see was the physical funds had started coming in and buying it. The hedge funds started coming in 05, 06, part of 04, started coming in, buying some physical uranium. And then when the utilities needed to start contracting, there wasn't enough production out there. And so they had to go and pay up. And they paid up, and you saw the hedge funds sitting on it. And you saw some huge price appreciation. And that opportunity is available today. And that's where somebody can express their view with significant amounts of capital.
You also have, Mike, the physical proxies as well.
Yeah, that's right.
The listed vehicles, UPC in Canada and Yellowcake in London. And I mean, full disclosure, we own both of those. But they are somewhat inexplicably both trading at 20% discounts to their NAV. So, I mean, not only are you getting access to physical uranium without having to have accounts at converters, but you're picking it up at a 20% discount to the current price.
It's nonsensical.
Now, why would physical uranium trade at a 20% discount? I mean, why wouldn't somebody buy all of it and liquidate it and consume it?
Well, I think probably because there's just not the, you know, the obvious buyer would be a utility, and I just don't think that's something that they're focused on. They haven't necessarily had a sense of urgency to be securing front dated pounds at the moment, and so therefore, you know, if they have considered it, they've sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, well, maybe that's a bit too hard. You know, I think as well with institutions, liquidity in some of these things makes it a little bit more difficult for them. And again, they've seen the price go from 23 to 34 and they've done nothing, and then it's come back to $30 here, and they've said, oh, well, we probably have another chance. So potentially, I mean, it's our view, you'll see that discount quickly disappear when the spot price runs again. But, you know, as Mike said before, the spot price running again requires, you know, more than just the sort of five or six guys, you know, having a tea committee meeting every day as to where it should be. It needs some actual real buying to come in and take that higher again.
Well, gentlemen, to wrap this up again for our investors, you do have the ETF option. The symbol is URNM. For at least Mike's fund, I think the best you can do is just hope for it to reopen again. But Mike and Guy, why don't you both please tell our listeners how they can find out, websites or whatever, more about your fund. Guy, your fund is still open, so let's start with you.
Yeah, sure, Eric. I mean, it's the easiest way is to go onto our website. That's www.tribecaip for investment partners.com, TRIBECAIP.com. And there's links there to our Global Natural Resources Fund, our Global Natural Resources Credit Fund, and also then the nuclear energy opportunities. So it's fairly easy, very easy to navigate.
And Mike, Sachem Cove Partners.
SachemCovePartners.com. And there's a contact button on there that people can inquire in there.
Okay. And again, for now, your fund is closed. So the only reason to contact you there would be if they wanted to find out if it reopens. Gentlemen, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. Kevin Muir and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Farmland investing has been a popular macro trend among billionaires and big institutions for the last decade. But the high cost of buying an entire farm put this asset class out of reach to all but big institutions and the ultra-rich. FarmTogether.com allows any accredited investor to invest in fractional ownership of several different categories of farmland. I recently did a full-length interview with FarmTogether.com founder and CEO, Artem Milinchuk. We discussed the macro argument for farmland investing, performance and correlation comparisons to conventional asset classes, and the different types of farmland and their investment characteristics. If you're an accredited investor, I recommend that you listen to that interview and learn why farmland investing might be a fit for your portfolio. You can find the download link in your Research Roundup email, or just type the word farmland into the search box on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Check out farmtogether.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts.
It was a great interview with Mike and Guy. Eric, lots to dig into. What was your key takeaway from it?
Well, it really got me thinking about uranium, and I think it's a long-term play, and it's an important one. And I'm so frustrated that I didn't think about this 6 months ago, because I pulled up a chart of URNM, which is the mining ETF, and it got clobbered in March like everything else did. But stop and think about that. I mean, it really, really got clobbered. It was just down hard. And, you know, of course that happened because everybody's panicking out of everything. Everybody's selling everything to raise cash. But think about it. You know, yes, there is a global pandemic that's very real. It doesn't mean that nuclear plants that have to continue producing electricity are going to stop needing fuel in the next 10 years. You know, there was no fundamental reason that you should expect a pandemic to affect the industry other than to the extent that if the pandemic resulted in shut-in of mining operations, that would drive the prices much higher initially. And it might hurt some of those miners initially, but eventually, you know, you would think that low was an incredible buying opportunity because you know it had to come back. And there was a lot of other parts of the economy where you're thinking, okay, well, if this pandemic continues for the next 10 years, you know, I don't want to bet on maybe going long on airline stocks because they might never come back. Well, you know that the uranium miners were going to be needed no matter what. So it was just such an incredible value play back in March. I would, if I ever saw another dip like that, I'm going to be watching URNM closely for that reason. I'd be buying it hand over fist. I did buy a little bit of URNM this week, just in full disclosure, because I think it's a great long-term story. The thing is, something's got to change in terms of sentiment for it really to go big. And I think these guys are absolutely right that, you know, the worst probably has to be over for uranium. It's a bullish story. It's a question of when the bullish story kicks into gear and how to be positioned for it that I think about the most. What was your reaction to it?
Well, Eric, it's funny that you mentioned the March sell-off in the uranium companies, because I had actually written a piece in January or February about how the uranium participation unit, which is basically a closed-end ETF that owns uranium, was a great place to hide if you were worried about the stock market. And my thinking was exactly what you just mentioned, the fact that if, let's face it, the demand for uranium should be fairly stable, and whether the virus hits and you know, causes all sorts of problems in the market shouldn't affect how much uranium the world uses. Unfortunately, I think that it was one of those things that many other hedge funds were in the same trade as me, and it ended up being that this uranium participation unit went from a 10% discount to NAV to like a 30 and 40% discount to NAV. Now, why do I like the uranium participation unit? As Mike and Guy talked about, the spot price of uranium trades at a discount to the forward prices of uranium, those long-term contracts that they talked about. Well, if you go look at the uranium participation unit, it trades at a discount to the spot price. So you're getting a discount upon a discount. I think that this thing's right now is trading at a 20-plus percent discount. Eventually, when we get a situation where we get the bull market resume, this thing could likely trade at a 20% premium. That's why I like the uranium participation unit as my way to play the uranium bull market.
Kevin, picking up on that same theme, they mentioned Yellowcake in this interview. I actually talked to them a little bit off the air afterwards. And Yellowcake, which is, I believe, YCA, Yankee Charlie Alpha on the London Stock Exchange, is another ticker for a company that holds physical uranium metal, Yellowcake Uranium. And it's trading at upwards of a 20% discount to NAV. And, you know, you just know that ultimately that uranium is going to be needed someday. And the thing that really got me thinking about all this, and we don't know yet, of course, what the outcome of the presidential race is going to be, but I think about President Trump's attitude, if he were to remain president, and the way that he likes to talk about America first and so forth. It makes me wonder if he understood this issue, that you're basically dependent on a lot of countries that President Trump is not a big fan of for uranium. You know, why is it that if the fuel that supplies these nuclear plants is such a small percentage of their overall operating cost, you know, why wouldn't they get a 20 or 30 year supply of fuel stockpiled to make sure they're ready and they're not dependent on anybody? Can you imagine a regulatory change that just says, you know, for the sake of national security, we don't want to be dependent on other nations for our uranium. All the nuclear plants are required or at least encouraged to, you know, keep a 20 year supply of fuel, which they can easily afford to do. A change like that, if it ever happened, would create a sudden demand spike that would just completely overwhelm the capacity of the mining industry and would be potentially, you know, a major win for investments either in things like YCA or URNM, the mining ETF, or anything else. So, and of course, we don't know if that's going to happen. We don't know what the outcome of the election is going to be. But at some point, it's crazy for the United States to be dependent on foreign partners for something that you can easily afford to stockpile. It doesn't make any sense.
You're 100% right, Eric. And we look at it, it seemed like a no-brainer for Trump to do. And that's why when Energy Fuels and the other companies, the North American producers, got together trying to put that bill through, there was a lot of anticipation that that was going to happen. Unfortunately, it ended up disappointing. But when you're thinking about the bigger term and the longer term picture, it makes sense. And therefore, you're just kind of shaking your head asking, why haven't government officials figured this out? And this is ultimately my problem with the kind of the uranium story. It's not really a problem, but it's just kind of a little bit of pushback is that this story has been bullish for a long time. And it's needing a catalyst. And I don't know if that catalyst is going to be this week, next month, next year even. I know eventually it's going to be a great investment. I'm just not sure about the timing.
Well, I'll tell you the way I think about that one. You know, we don't know what the election is going to bring. Maybe it's going to be a clean sweep and a big sigh of relief and everything is straight up. But if we had another big March-sized sell-off in markets, boy, if URNM got anywhere close to where it was, or for that matter, YCA and the other plays on the metal itself, I'd be buying it hand over fist. I'm so frustrated that I didn't think of this back in March. But Kevin, speaking of the election coming up and so forth, let's move on to markets more broadly. A lot of people are expecting that, okay, you know, we're going to wait. There's going to be maybe nothing happens until the election and there's some huge move in one direction or the other. Is that the right way to think about this? If not, why not? And how do you think about it?
I do think it's the right way, Eric. I did some work because I was kind of curious about thinking about the volatility going into the election. I thought to myself, is the move that we're going to experience, like, are we going to have some big, you know, violent move before or is it going to be after? So I went through and I looked back at the past election since 1992. And what I did was I took September 1st all the way to election date. And what I took was the high range and the low range of that period. And then I figured out the percentage of that move. And what I found was that on average, in those 2 months, the stock market moves 12%, 11.9%. Now, you have to remember, this had the 2008 time period in it, and that was 36%, that range. So if we take that out, because let's face it, that's not going to happen again. That was an extraordinary circumstance. If we take it out, we'll see that the range was actually 7.84%. Now, if we go look at 2020, the time right now, we've already traversed, you know, a range of 10.73%. So when I look at this, you know, coming 2 weeks between now and November 3rd, I think to myself, you know, there's a good chance that the high and low are both in and that we are going to get, as we were talking about earlier, a whole lot of nothing and that the stock market is just going to end up kind of frustrating both the bulls and the bears. What do you think?
Well, you're saying that's up until the election, and I would definitely agree with that. The thing that I don't know about is after the election, I think there's at least a significant chance of an escalation of civil unrest. And the problem that I have in figuring this out is really, if you look at history and even go back to the late 1960s, when there was a huge amount of, you know, civil discourse, division in society, riots and protests and so forth, it really didn't affect the stock market adversely very much at all. Because despite the fact that that was a very, very challenging time and there was a lot of disagreement in society, it was a very big social issue. people still kept on buying products and, the economy kept going and it didn't really affect the stock market. On the other hand, if you have a situation that truly escalates to the point where the government's ability to maintain control over society comes into question, well, especially for the U.S. dollar and I think also for the stock market, okay, that's different. It's a different game at that point. And the question I'm asking myself is, at what point does it become different? Let's suppose that, and I think this is very possible, unfortunately, let's suppose that after the election, both sides feel like their guy won. Everybody's pissed off. It's not really clear who the president is. And furthermore, there are outbreaks of violence across America where people are feeling like the other side is trying to undermine the democratic process and steal the election for their candidate. And they're fighting back violently in the form of riots and so forth. Well, that by itself, it just means that companies that manufacture riot gear for police are going to, sell more of them. So it doesn't really adversely affect the stock market. Unless those riots go completely out of control to the point where society starts to shut down because, let's say protesters are occupying, downtown areas of cities and shutting down major highways and blocking them so traffic can't get through in order to make their point. Well, now that directly affects commerce and it does affect markets. So what's the point where a political escalation turns into an economic escalation? And how do you know when you've reached it? I think that's the right question to ask. I don't have any answers.
So I will tell you one thing, Eric. A lot of my hedge fund buddies in the States are talking about that possibility. There was one buddy that actually told me that he thought there's a good chance that the stock market will close for an extended period of time. He didn't say that that was for sure going to happen, but he kind of put that out there. He said, this is a possibility that this happens. Whenever I see that much worry, I feel like that the right trade is to take the other side. And I am hopeful that it is not going to end up being as bad as everyone thinks it is. I am hopeful that you're going to have an election. And even if it's contested, it's going to be done in a calm measure. And yes, maybe there are pockets and outbreaks of violence in certain spots. But I just don't think that selling stocks on that worry is the right call. And listen, it might be that I've just made a fool of myself and, we're going to be talking and the S&P will be down 20% lower when this happens. But I just think over time, when I think back to all the worries that when people start telling me that they're worried about something like this, it rarely comes to be. And most often when everyone's worried about something, most likely the best trade is to go the other way.
Well, I want to push back on that just a little bit, Kevin, because when a war starts, one of the most widely known and easily proven facts is that the war is usually going to be bullish in the long run for the stock market. But there's almost always an initial, oh my God, it's a war, panic selling, knee-jerk reaction, and it's down first, and that's a buy-the-dip opportunity because you know that it was emotion and panic that drove that move down, and eventually it's going to move up. So don't you think that if you get a situation where violence escalates beyond what we've seen so far in cities across America, that there's a lot of room for at least a temporary knee-jerk panic down?
Oh, I won't deny that. You're absolutely right, Eric. But let's remember on the Trump one, he won. We had that knee-jerk panic down, and by the open, it was back up. And I think it finished up on that day. And so I just think that it's one of these... It's when something is so widely watched and so widely expected, I just don't think that going in, especially if you're going and trying to buy, protection via options, those will be fully priced into that outcome. And that rarely does that work. And now I will give you credit. I think that the one time that it actually did work was with the virus. And you were there saying this is going to get worse, and you said it. And I remember you and I was on this show, and after the show, you told me this was the market basically doing the largest mispricing in history that you'd ever seen. And you were spot on correct.
But this is the opposite. This is the opposite. Everybody is overthinking this. And, you know, there's so much optionality that's already been bought. The hedges have already been purchased. And you've got to think about people lifting those hedges as soon as there is a more certain outcome than the one they feared. So, you know, that's the bullish argument. But frankly, the bearish argument, Kevin, is I think we're going to go longer than we've ever gone in the history of the nation before we know with certainty who the next president of the United States is. It's not going to be certain on election night, and I'll be surprised if by December 1st there is widespread agreement on who that is, and I won't be surprised at all if on January 1st there's still strong disagreement as to who the president really is. And at that point, it'll be in the hands of the Supreme Court, and, you know, we'll see what happens. But even a Supreme Court decision, it doesn't mean that, you know, the half of the country who feels that that decision is invalid, it doesn't change the fact that they're going to be very upset and expressing their anger, and who knows how they're going to be expressing it.
I hope not, but I'm gonna kind of not sell the American people short, and I'm gonna say that I'm confident that they're gonna do the right thing, and that it's not gonna be a case of whoever wins, the other side's gonna burn the country to the ground because of it. And I'm hopeful that we're gonna look back, and whoever happens to win this election, it'll be still, you know, America doing better, you know, a year from now, and we're just going to look back and remember this little blip of some disagreement, and that's all it'll be, a little blip of disagreement.
Well, Kevin, I sure hope that you're right, and I'll tell you what, let's leave it there on a positive note for this week's show. Folks, Patrick Ceresna will be back next week for those of you who have been missing him, and we look forward to seeing you for next week's show when we've got another terrific guest lined up. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by FarmTogether.com, making farmland investing a $1 trillion asset class available to all accredited investors, and by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info.
So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and Patrick Ceresna at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, myself, Kevin Muir, and Patrick Ceresna, thank you for listening and have a great week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.